Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why? Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, September 29th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the internet at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and look for the Start Here words, the words Start Here on the upper left-hand corner, tap that link. It'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download off of one of the links on that page the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. There's also a link there for a whole host of audio files of shows like this one where people have been stepped through the use of that tool. If you choose to listen to those, they can serve as a tutorial for you to help you get the most benefit out of that tool in the shortest amount of time. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app. It contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives when they use these tools. It also tends to promote comments, questions, answers, and testimonials, and we'd be happy to entertain any of those from you if you have the ability to call in right now. If you're live, the number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll let me know that you want to talk, and I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. You can also email Jeannie at Jeannie at whyagain.org. Or you can email me, tjh at mindshifters-academy.org, and we can have a conversation. We'll discuss your email on the call, on the show one of these days, and then send you an email letting you know when we were able to address your comment, question, or answer, or testimonial. So, how can we support you? What's on your mind today? Area code 610. I'm trying to turn on your microphone. Is this Susan?
Hi. Hi, Dr. Tim. I wanted to ask you if you've heard of this Australian biologist named Jeremy Griffiths. Sounds like an actor or a famous person. But I think he just died. He's a scientist. And I just discovered him the other day and listened to a very long-winded, difficult-to-understand podcast. His accent is hard to understand, but basically what he's saying is what Michael has been teaching, but it's from another angle. He says Adam and Eve were brave. They were heroes to leave the Garden of Eden. They wanted to know stuff, and God said, you know, don't touch this because it's an apple from the tree of knowledge, and they wanted knowledge, and they forfeited their innocence in a way, not innocence, he doesn't use that word, he forfeited their having to live instinctually and unconsciously. They wanted to understand more than they already did. So as soon as they took the apple, they got conscious in a certain way that gave them an intellect. And Jeremy Griffiths aligns the intellect with the ego and just says, as soon as you have an intellect, you've got an ego. And in the Bible, it says this was a bad thing to do. And humanity has felt guilty and bad ever since. And they have suffered because they think they're bad. And they argue and fight with one another. And one has to be right and one has to be wrong. And he says all the difficulties between human beings, in fact, the sort of the very human condition itself, comes from this belief that we are bad. And he said, if we were to look upon Adam as Eve and Eve as heroes, everything would change. And he points out, I don't know what you call them, a colony of baboons or chimpanzees called bonobo. He said, if you go into their own culture, they live totally affectionately and easily and lovingly in community with one another, and there's none of this strife. He uses that as an example of how we could be and how we really are if we didn't feel the guilt that we feel. He says we are innocent, and that's where it hitches up with Michael Rice's worksheet and what you always say at the end of the show. We were come from love. We were made. We are love. Everything else is false. If we really believed that, he says, humanity would be have a very different experience of itself. And a lot of the problems that are getting more and more intense would go away. I haven't done enough reading and research to pull together all the things he says, but my mind was blown because I thought, here's another one. Tim Hayes has to hear about this guy because you're finding people from all over the place who are basically saying the same thing. He says the answer comes from science. We don't need religion. Well, I'm not so sure any of that is really true. I think religion is trying to get us to understand that we are loved, at least Christianity does. So anyway, I'll stop talking there, and I didn't even let you answer the question. Have you heard of him? Jeremy Griffin.
I have not heard of him. And so does he have things on YouTube? Has he written a book? How did you find him?
I saw somebody posted on Facebook and said, you've got to listen to this. And I thought, well, okay. And he's on YouTube, and he has written books. I haven't read any of his books. I would suggest if you wanted to, there is a little podcast that came after where somebody in his audience, one of his audiences says, can you summarize your theory? And for 12 minutes he talks, and it's pretty good. And there's also a transcript of the long talk. And I printed that, and I find it much easier to work with than trying to strain to understand his language. It's a very good interview. The interviewer is brilliant himself. But nevertheless, it's a challenge. It's about an hour and a half long, I think, the talk.
So, is that the one called the interview that solves the human condition and saves the world?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that it?
Yep. You found that pretty fast.
Well, that's, you know, that's not that big a claim. Just to solve the human condition,
right,
and save the world? That's not too pumped,
right,
up.
Right. No, not too pumped up. But I think Michael's been trying to do that in his own way, in a more modest way. This guy is very appealing, by the way. He sounds a little overblown in the title, but sounds like a wonderful man. And I think he just died. He was in his 70s. Anyway, I just thought this take on Adam and Eve was wonderful, that they were brave. I love that idea.
Well,
they weren't.
I can certainly agree with anything that says, look on the bright side of things, give up the guilt, give up the shame, give up the blame. I can certainly agree with that.
Right.
I don't know about everything he's saying about it. It sounds as though, you know, on the one hand, when you're saying it, it almost sounds as though he's going for the literal interpretation of Adam and Eve, et cetera. And, of course, we've had this conversation before. And I let people know it's never made sense to me, and I've never been attracted to philosophies or theologies that take those kinds of stories literally, because there's so
mm-hmm.
much evidence that they were never intended to be literal, that they were used as
yeah.
allegories and myths and parables. And so if he goes down that path and starts talking about it as a literal thing, I won't be able to go very far down that path. But I can certainly understand that the core of the teaching from the Course in Miracles and the Way of Mastery and Michael Rice's stuff and Guy Finley's stuff is that it doesn't do any good to beat yourself up and to judge yourself negatively and to carry shame and guilt and blame. It's all in your own head. You're creating it there.
Right.
And it's not a productive thing to do. It has a whole set of consequences that are quite directly observable, and you probably don't like those consequences. So it's a good thing to question, is it worth my continuing to do that?
Right. He does give a better story, the Adam and Eve story he uses, because we all know it, and it's archetypal or mythological or whatever it is. I don't think he's taking it literally at all. He's inviting us to look at ourselves a different way. He gives another example that might be better. He names this stork, a bird, Adam Stork, and Adam is flying with other storks, migrating by instinct from the north to the south. But Adam Stork has been given a conscious brain all of a sudden. So he's flying along, and he looks down, and he sees a little island with an apple tree on it. And he knows instinctually, he knows that he's supposed to be migrating with his fellow storks. But he looks down and wants to try this apple and get some food. So he dives down, and he feels guilty. There you have it, the beginning of the split, the feelings about oneself. He feels guilty for leaving his other birds. They are mad at him for breaking ranks. And Jeremy Griffiths says it's very interesting that when truth is introduced, a new truth, it's often considered a blasphemy. So I like this idea that once he did that, he couldn't go back to being just his instinctual self. He had this mind that was going to send him into other realms and lead him to explore, lead him to be ostracized, hated, abandoned, whatever. So I think that's a better example. And so Adam Stork would tend to see himself as maybe a bad person, a bad stork or a renegade, or blame himself where he really shouldn't be. He's actually just evolving in a wonderful way. Jeremy says that our consciousness that we are conscious, is one of the greatest things ever. And it's the top of the evolutionary chain. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it sounds right. So.
Well, so he's not the first to say that. That's the essence of all of these great Eastern teachings. You know, there's I forget the name of the teacher who his entire teaching was just to ask people, who are you?
Yeah.
Who are you? Day after day, time after time, who are you? Who is it that thinks that he or she knows who you are? What is it that you are?
Yeah.
And the more you get in touch with that, the more you're getting in touch with pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And so, you know, he might be talking about an ancient truth in a slightly different way that's resonating with you, and that's great because that's what all of this work we're doing on this internet show is about.
Which reminds
me, we are not trying
of
to reinvent the wheel.
Right, you were talking about the difference between secrecy and privacy. And you gave one example of a person who was having lunch with somebody else, and the somebody else reached for a potato chip and took it, and the person had a fantasy of chopping off his or her hand and chopping up the fingers. Where I differ from what you were either reading or saying, it's good to know that you have that thought, but I don't agree with the fact that you then tell your lunch mate that you had that thought.
Well, of
that's
course you don't
harsh.
Agree with that. You were raised in this culture. And
on,
I wasn't
Dr.
making that up. That's right in the way of mastery.
It is? Oh, my God. Well, why would you suggest saying that out loud?
Take a breath or two and clear your throat and soften because...
Oh, sorry. I've got allergies.
That's all right.
Yeah.
But just soften and relax into this. You know, the fact that you're even asking that question means that the message of this lesson has a long way to go to get in for you. Right? This is not about your social network. This is not about fitting in with the culture or the family. This is about the deep spiritual truth that the more you can be wide open and honest about your actual thought process, your emotions, etc., the less you are enslaved by the shoulds and the thoughts about what's right and what's wrong. If you want a mind that's free, that's liberated, that's what this lesson is telling us. If you want liberty, if you want freedom in your mind, you must be able to be allowing of everything. You must be willing to be wide open and honest about everything. Because anything that you are not willing to be honest about enslaves you. It takes your own mind energy to try and hide that from you. It's tying your mind in knots.
It is not. I don't think I made myself clear, or we're having a real problem with communication. Every day I am aware of negative thoughts, ill wishing towards somebody. I'm that guy Fenelon through and through. And I see that. I notice that. But I don't act on it. And I don't think you recommend acting on it either. But being fully honest doesn't require acting on those things, or you'd have a terrible mess.
Well, I agree with everything you just said.
Okay.
And I don't think that has anything to do with what I was talking about.
then I didn't get you what you were saying.
I am not talking about acting on a thought. I'm talking about how what you just said was completely false, because you said, I have all these negative thoughts every day. So let me tell you the story of the three umpires. Long day of the weekend, they're out there calling games all day, and in the evening they gather for some drinks at a bar. There's three of them. And the first one says, well, you know, guys, there's balls and strikes, and I call them as they are. And the other one goes, well, you know, there's balls and strikes, and I call them as I see them. And the third one gets up there, and she says, well, you know what, guys? There's only pitches until I call them.
I didn't understand that yesterday when you said that, and I don't understand that story even now.
It doesn't surprise me at all.
Okay.
Which is why we're misconnecting right now, right? You don't have a bunch of negative thoughts all day long. You have a bunch of thoughts, and you label them negative. You've been trained to think that they're so bad and horrible. And you've been trained to think that there's something wrong with you for having them. None of that is true anywhere but in your own mind. That's the point of this kind of a lesson. To understand that it's our labeling of it, it's the value we give those thoughts that creates their meaning, their impact on us and in our world. Nothing else. That's the meaning of the lesson that's titled, All Events Are Neutral. And over again, people read that or hear about a lesson like that, and they say, how could that be? That can't be possible. Look at this hurricane. This is horrible. This is a tragedy. Look at this child who's ill. And my only response to that is, okay, if you want to create that experience for yourself, you can. You have the infinite capacity to choose the focus of your conscious awareness moment to moment. You have the infinite capacity to judge these things as bad or wrong. And once you do, that will be how you create your experience of life and your experience of those certain thoughts.
I understand that, but how does that fit with Way of Mastery saying we need to be totally self-honest? So are you saying I notice the thought that I want to murder somebody, but I don't label it? I just see the thought as just a thought. I guess that's
right.
What you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't need to beat myself up over it. I don't need to go into this, oh, my gosh, how did that happen? How could I think such a horrible thing? What is wrong with me? Am I turning into an axe murderer? I don't need to go there.
Yeah.
You launched into, well, we shouldn't act on these thoughts. Well, there's nothing in the Way of Mastery or anything I said that I'm aware of that says you should act on that.
The example in the book, when you read it, where the person actually told his lunch partner, hey, I just had this fantasy that I chopped off your hand. And
Yeah, but that's not acting on the thought. That's not chopping off the hand. That's not attacking the other person. That's just being honest. That's being wide open. That's acknowledging our shared experience. That's the reverse of trying to pretend that I'm so loving and I'm so holy and I'm so good at practicing these spiritual practices. It's the reverse of the fakeness, because everyone has had negative thoughts. Everyone in every walk of life has the same kinds of thoughts, some more extreme than others, some more intense than others. But what they're trying to point out in these deep spiritual texts is that we are swimming in consciousness, in the mind energy that is universal. All minds are joined. And so to pretend that I am holier than you are is an absolute farce. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. I am the great and powerful Dr. Hayes. Right? I am so good at knowing the way of mastery. I'm living this like no one's ever lived it. It's all a farce. And you don't have to do what the way of mastery recommends. But the way of mastery, and whatever it is as a teaching, is saying that it's been the experience of the authors or the consciousness that authored this, that the way to get more and more liberty and freedom, the way to move out of the patterns that we've been trained into by our family and our culture, is to be more and more deeply self-honest, wide open. There's a Q&A from the Way of Mastery where JM stays in the mindset of channeling Yeshua, and they're asking Yeshua these questions. And one of them says, hey, why don't you get this teacher that you know that teaches, I forget whether it's Course in Miracles or something else, and suggest to her that you start this group and you get together, and all you do is all week long, you just make notes of your thoughts, and then you get together and start sharing them. Absolutely wide open. No censoring whatsoever. He calls it, this is called undressing in front of a friend.
How cool.
Right?
Yeah,
just every, I wanted to just slam my car into this goose that was, you know, just sauntering across the, oh my God, I love animals. How could you do that? Well, I didn't say I was going to. I just had the thought. I'm going to be open about that. Just like the thoughts that were in the Way of Mastery lesson that we read yesterday. Isn't that interesting? When you reached across the table and grabbed the potato chip off my plate, I had an image of stabbing your hand with a fork. Now, it doesn't mean I pick up a fork and stab at your hand. We're not talking about acting on the thoughts. We're talking about getting that judgment that, oh, that's a bad thought, and canceling it or releasing it and saying, wow, isn't that interesting? I just had this kind of thought. I'm not hiding it from myself or anybody else. I'm not letting it be an excuse for my taking an action that would have negative consequences. I'm just wide open. And you don't need to do that. You don't need to do any of these exercises. As a matter of fact, in one of the lessons, I think probably moving into the Way of Transformation, they said, if you want, get yourself a notebook and a special pen and put it in a special place. And then just write down, we give these exercises, including writing down, I don't want to do this exercise. That's perfectly okay. Mm-hmm. Just own the fact that you're making the choice.
Yeah.
Stepping into the realization that you do have that choice. And as the Way of Mastery and one of the Darshans pointed out, as probably a Q&A, your free will cannot be usurped. You will always have the choice to judge your thoughts as bad or negative, to share them or keep them private, to think that you're better than somebody because you don't share your negative thoughts or your thoughts that you would label negative, to think that you're better than somebody who either shares their negative thoughts and thinks they're good or doesn't share their thoughts and thinks they're better than you, etc. You have the infinite capacity to decide what you do with your mind energy. And what you choose to do with it is going to create your experience of life. And it's all going to be okay. It may not be optimal for the way you've planned out your life. It may not be optimal for some plan that you have for the world's environment or economy. And yet, these great spiritual teachings tell us it's okay. You
well,
have the
a lot of stuff is coming up
to
listening to this.
Okay, what is it?
Tim Bingham and I went to a retreat years ago when we were just very young, newly married. It was with a man who called himself a bioenergetics therapist. His name was John Paracas, and he was in New York City. We went to this retreat, and there were maybe 50 people there. We formed a big circle, and he said, and we'd been together for a while, so people did have impressions of us. We all had impressions of one another. And we were invited to go around, take turns going around the room and pointing out one person or another and telling them what we really thought of them. And one woman pointed at me and said, "You're much too..." I can't even remember the word. "You're much too flighty and superficial for your husband. You are like a lightweight, and he's a serious person. And he really, you're not worthy of him." And I've never forgotten that. That really hurt. And I guess I feel as if we human beings on the planet are not loving enough or healed enough to be that open with someone if it's something hurtful. We're just not advanced enough to be able to take it. Even with the person who took the potato chip and saying, "You know, it's funny, I had this fantasy." Part of me, if I was being told that, would think, "Whoa, that person really doesn't like me. I'm out of here."
Let's stop and correct you where you said that really hurt. And let's help you understand how that's denial.
Yeah, I understand that it is. I'm telling you how I reacted, that's all.
No, you were telling me that hurt you.
I felt hurt.
Right. So how did you feel hurt? Well, here's what we understand about us as humans. Have you ever had the fear that deep down inside, you are actually a four-legged, long-haired creature with a big tail, a long nose that eats ants?
No, but I know where you're going, and right.
Okay, well, because I've done it before. So if that woman had come up to you in that exercise and said, "Here's what I really think about you. I think, in truth, you're an aardvark parading around as a human," would that have generated pain in you? And the answer is no, because there's no part of you that secretly thought at any level that you were an aardvark. So when you have a lot of upset come up, it's from inside of you, the part of you that's wondered, "Am I good enough for him? Is he too smart for me?"
Mm-hmm.
And if you had... Yes, that's absolutely true. This is just like we have gravity on this planet, and that's a true statement because that's the way we work as human beings, right? If somebody comes up to me today and tells me I'm a lousy therapist, it has nowhere near the impact it would have had on me if I was only 5 years or 10 years into doing therapy, because I still had some questioning about, am I any good at this, or is there more to learn, or did I do the right thing in the last session? So the idea is, this statement that you're making about how we as humans aren't ready for this is coming off of an example like that. Here's the evidence, because this woman said this, and this really deeply hurt me. And none of that's true. So if we come back and we examine the dynamic and we say, wait a minute, the foundational statement that you're using to reach the conclusion that human beings aren't ready for that kind of honesty is a false statement. So you know what happens when you build a logical structure based on a false set of premises? It all falls apart once you see the truth of the false premise. Now, would there be a lot of disruption? Absolutely. Why? Because we've spent decades and sometimes in some cases, you know, generation upon generation building these false negative thought structures and beliefs about what causes our pain and suffering. And that's, as as Abraham Hicks would say, and that's got a lot of momentum behind it. So that's like an aircraft carrier. It can turn, but it's not going to turn on a dime. There's going to be a whole process of practicing and observing and the willingness to see the truth. And so when you have an example like that in this work, we would say, okay, let's go back and have me remember that situation and apply what I've learned in the last 20, 30, 40 years about how I'm creating my own emotions. And let me look a little bit deeper at what was my own insecurity at that time and how much value was I giving to what this woman was saying, and how might I step back and once I dismantle some of my fear and upset from that, have a different look at this woman and say, oh, wow, she must not feel very adequate for her to generate that kind of a negative statement about somebody else. And then I move from there, if I want to start building some kind of a conclusion about how life would go today if people were that much more honest, then I start building the conclusions from the actual accurate observations of what was causing my upset all those years ago.
Good. I get it.
And I don't know the truth of what would happen if everybody started being as honest as the way of mastery is suggesting we do in this. I don't know what will actually happen. I don't even know how to digest the food I had for breakfast.
Why does he say that if we withhold our truth, we can sit there and be smug and feel superior? I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. I don't know why those things are together in that idea. If I choose not to tell the person about my fantasy, I don't think I'm going to feel superior. I would just be noticing my thought and being glad that I'm not.
Okay, but I don't think it says that that's exactly what you're doing every time. He says you can do it that way.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of us are conditioned to do, to try to be pious. Mm. He's talking about the Pharisees, you know, standing on the corner in their beautiful robes and talking about how pious they are. In truth, they're not being very honest and they're not doing their work. And the only way they can do that is by hiding the truth from themselves and others.
Mm.
I don't think he says that every time you hide the truth, you're actively just trying to make things worse for other people or anything like that. I just think he's saying that that's what happens for a lot of people when they try to pretend that they're holier than thou or they don't have negative thoughts, is that they're leaving the door open for them to feel better than somebody.
Yeah, I understand. Well, and now I have another question about something you were saying the other day. And that is the difference between privacy and secrecy. My best friend 20 years ago, she got pregnant. She had teenagers, and she got pregnant by accident with him. And he confided in me that, oh, my God, we're going to have another baby. I'll have to stay with her for another 10 years. He said that to me. I did not tell her that he said that to me. So that's a secret. But it's a secret that absolutely had to be kept. I was not going to tell her because he had his own agenda. And they're still together and still trying to work things out, and they have their problems and they have their good things. And but that particular thing made me think that what happened between him and me in my decision about what to do with what he said didn't fall within the parameters of what you were talking about. Is it private? Is it a secret? Is it a bad thing? It's just been on my mind.
Well, okay. Is there a question in there for me?
No, I guess I'm being critical. I think that there was another, it was a little too simple.
Critical of what?
The secrets and the privacy definitions. There's more nuance there between having a secret and being private.
Okay, so I would have to agree with that at some level, because that's what I was saying yesterday, is that the more I talk about this, I used to talk about it in therapy sessions, and it was very simple, and I have a nice set of ways to talk about it, and there are some nuances in that. However, when we come to a spiritual teaching like the Way of Mastery, I said, I have to think more carefully about and choose my words and parse them out differently. Specifically because I think, for one thing, one of the ways that the Way of Mastery is talking about privacy, et cetera, in this work, it kind of blends over into my use of the word secrecy, where I'm actively thinking I'm going to keep this a secret. And as I do, it's a bad or negative thing about me, and it's feeding a conclusion that I'm damaged or broken and unlovable, and that if whoever I'm keeping the secret from finds out about it, they're either going to attack me or run away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of blending into the way of mastery is using the word privacy. But my thought about this example that you're giving with your friend is, that's just privacy. Your friend shared something with you. You're not directly involved. It's not your decision one way or another. It's not like, you know, it's something you did that you're keeping to yourself because if somebody found out about it, they would attack you or run away from you. This is just not your business.
Yeah.
And somebody shared this with you. And it is his or her business, their business, and it's up to them to deal with it and share it with whoever they want. As a private matter, probably pretty good bet that she knows that there's tension in that relationship.
Oh, yeah. Without question.
It probably wouldn't have made one bit of difference for the good for you to tell her this is what he said. It would have put strain on your relationship with him or ended it, and it wouldn't have made any difference in their relationship because they're living in it. They know that they've got issues and struggles and challenges. Mm. So that's not in the category of something where you were keeping it a secret or that you should have told her. That's just not the kind of thing that we're talking about. That falls in the category,
good.
As far as I'm concerned, as privacy.
Yeah, okay, good.
And if you study this work and you're better at it and you have a friend who comes to you and tells you that kind of thing, you might coach them about, if you hear or you feel from them as they're talking about this that they're judging themselves negatively or they're beating themselves up for it, you might coach them to let go of that negativity. And you can do that, coaching them to let go of their negativity without trying to tell them whether to stay or leave in the marriage or without trying to tell them that they should tell their partner, because that's none of your business.
Right.
That's their private matter.
Right.
So that's just some thoughts about that. It's not that what I'm saying is right or wrong. It's just that, to try and help clarify, I don't think there's anything in what we were talking about yesterday as I was giving commentary or what the Way of Mastery was saying that would judge you as wrong for keeping that private?
No, I didn't feel as if I was wrong. I just thought this is a different, this doesn't fit in either slot. It's not a secret exactly in
well,
the sense
I,
they
I think it. I think it does fit in the privacy area.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Like there are times when I tell people something in confidence. There are times all day long when people come into therapy and they tell me things in confidence, expecting
right.
that I will keep it private.
Right. Yeah.
And if it's anything, if it's anything where I can clearly determine that it's a secret they're holding on to and that in that process they're doing themselves, you know, mental, emotional negativity and harm, then I will coach them about choosing differently. I won't choose for them unless somebody's going to get hurt or I reasonably believe somebody's being
right.
abused. Then I won't break the confidentiality, but I might encourage them to reconsider
yeah.
holding on to the secret or opening up and releasing that stress and pressure and improving their lives.
Yeah.
By being more
that's
wide open. Make sense?
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Tim. Well, whatever you were planning today,
this was it.
You have a little time left.
Well, this was it. This was. I opened it up and I said, if anybody's got comments or questions, and as I said, I try to say this every day. This makes it a lot easier for us to live into our intention with this work when people like you call and say, what about this? What about that? Did I hear you right? Did you just say that I was wrong or she was wrong? Or that it just makes it easier for us to be of service when people let us know what those questions are.
Speaking of things on minds, you read us beginning of chapter probably 21 or 2 where all those wonderful statements are. I am never alone.
That's 21.
I'll get them. Yeah.
That's 21.
Yeah, okay. I think we've talked about this before, but I'm sure Michael Rice would take issue with the language. It's all in the negative.
You know,
so I wrote
about,
him up.
Yeah, you can
yeah.
you can rewrite them with different, you know, what he would call regulatory speech. And we've done that
yeah.
before. We've had that on this show yeah. where we've gone through and tried to reword them so that it's they're stated positively. Were you going to
right.
offer some of those?
No,
have you
I could,
them?
But I have, and I use them in the other way, the positive way. But I read them to my Mind Shifters group the other day, and we're doing them. I told them about how they could act as mind shifters, take a week on one, and I sent them the whole bunch of them, and I thought maybe one or another might resonate more, and they could pick that one. Anyway, it's just nice to have this, like a little handle on things. Love is always with me. I have company at all times, or God is with me always. I will live forever, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so you just rewrote them with better regulatory speech, as Michael would say, or from the positive
yeah.
perspective.
Right.
Yeah, and it's possible for them to be just as effective that way.
Yeah. I was hoping that
everything
they would be
I do,
even more.
Everything I do is... You know, this one about it's not possible for you to harm anyone or anything, you might rewrite that as, everything I do is a blessing to me and those around me.
Right. That's good. Sorry about the sound effects, Tim.
You're most welcome and deserving. I'm turning on the microphone for area code 248, who's raised a hand. Who do we have? You're in the air. If you're talking, you're muted. If it was an unintentional pressing of the number one. Hello.
I am checking in because I called Tini to find out if she was around to field a call from someone I'm working with, and she told me that the session was pre-recorded.
You have a microphone going that's catching everything you're saying on the delay. So I'm going to play a recording for them because Arya Rain is ill, and so they're asking for thoughts and prayers and blessings, and they're going to be trying to work.
Okay, so there should be another phone number on the dashboard. 517.
There's another 517 at the bottom of the list. Are you asking me to turn on
person's
microphone?
I want to take a call with me to support this person.
Okay, we've only got 7 minutes left. Do you think that's a good idea? Is it that kind of quick one-shot deal? Or should we wait until tomorrow?
I guess if you think that if you're bringing up the concern about waiting, then that is enough to just postpone it.
Well, it could be, but I don't know. Maybe it's a quick question. We have 7 minutes. You're the one who knows what it's about.
Listen. When I was thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, we need 10 minutes. Usually get to the bottom of these things really kind of quick. So, I don't know. Let's take 5 minutes.
So whose hand am I raising at 517? Area code 517, you're in the air.
My name's Libby.
Was that Libby?
Yeah.
Okay, welcome. How can we support you today?
I was working through a mind shifter that Michelle and I developed that I kind of hit a spot of being stuck with feeling pretty painful. And she encouraged that we need to work this out with the two of you.
So it's like she began the mind shifter and she did it for well over an hour and brought up a lot of things. And it feels like almost incomplete. Now, optimally, right, you'd be able to do a breath session. And so in the absence of that, because that's something I wouldn't necessarily send her solo for the first time, sending her back in for, doing more of that same mind shifter. She's familiar with worksheets. So kind of just sort of exploring, sort of in bringing everything up and then not really having a place to land it all, maybe. Does that sound accurate, Libby?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, the thing that comes to mind for me to say is that developing resources within the person, and what does that mean? Visualizations, memories from the past they can tap into, ways to, one of Michael Rice's key tools for this is called the love exchange. And you can do the love exchange with another person. You can do the love exchange in the mirror. And the point of it is that you practice your ability to bring on good physical, emotional vibrations within your body. You remember good times, and you bring it up so the energy is moving through your system. That same kind of concept is done a lot in therapy, where they're doing somatic therapy and trauma work therapy, where they say, before we dig into this too deep, let's make sure we've developed the resources within you as a person. Your ability to go back and remember the people in your life that were the strongest, most loving, the most defensive of you, the most reassuring, the most consistent, and bring up those memories and feel the energy within your system and breathe into it and get grounded in the moment to realize you're safe. And then you have this as a tool you can bring about anytime you're doing a chunk of work on some other topic and you get triggered to upset and tears and you feel shaky inside, and you can take a breath and step back and do something like the EFT tapping or the love exchange with somebody, or the work that Lynn Grabhorn would have in her book, where she says, just remember this memory where you had this tremendous feeling of success or contentment or accomplishment, and dig into the details and breathe until you feel that energy vibrating through your system and let it flow through you. So that's what I would say at times like this. When we have somebody, this happened in our support group on Tuesday night, somebody called in and started talking about something, and the next thing you know, they were having difficulty breathing steadily, and they had a pain in their stomach. And we said, well, instead of trying to do a worksheet or a mind shifter on this, why don't you just do some rounds of EFT tapping and breathing? Why don't you just remind yourself you're safe, you're in a climate-controlled room, there's no, you know, venomous snakes trying to bite you, there's nobody trying to hit you. In this moment, you're whole and complete as you are, and what you're feeling when these tears are coming up or this sadness or this pain in your stomach is energy that's not flowing because you're resisting its flow. So whether you do breath work or you do EFT tapping or you do a visualization about the people in your lives who've always been there for you and are the most loving and the most compassionate, and you shift the energy flow, don't worry about making progress on this mind shifter or this worksheet. Worry about restoring yourself to your awareness of the truth in this moment. You're okay. This too shall pass. This is just energy. And if I can breathe and soften and let that energy flow through me, strengthen my ability to get grounded in the moment. There's that exercise we can do where we notice three things we can see in the room we're in, and then we notice three things we can hear in the room we're in, and then we notice three things we can feel in the room we're in, and take a breath and then cycle through that again until we get grounded in the moment. And in this moment, your heart is beating, your breath is moving, your food is digesting, you're okay. And then once you've strengthened your ability to get back to that calm state, and you know you can pull it up when you need it again if you get triggered to upset, then when you choose, you can re-engage something like a reality management worksheet process or a mind shifter tool. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. That's very helpful, actually. Thank you.
Yeah, there's no timeline on this. My problems are going to be there tomorrow, too. I can come back and work on them tomorrow, or I can leave them locked away in some kind of a mental compartmentalization until my next vacation in 6 months. All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Thanks, Michelle and Libby, and I will mute you all and get ready for the transition to the second hour today, which is going to be the fourth hour of the Why book. Again, we're asking for prayers and blessings to go to Michael and Jeannie, because the granddaughter that they've been helping to raise is working through some physical challenges right now, and they would appreciate any loving thoughts and blessings. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff that we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
Well, it's necessary to fight back and protect yourself.
It is participation in that kind of thinking that is causing violence to become the norm in our culture, Richard. People tend to be so close to what they do, they cannot see their own insanity. Be assured that from within the society ruled by the volcano gods, sacrificing young maiden now and then was not bizarre. Torturing and burning people at the stake was not strange from within the belief system of the inquisitors. It was a reasonable way to save souls. Reason, when not consciously governed, can justify anything it can conceive of, anything that it decides to do. We live in a world where murder, war, and violence are justified and condoned. Verbal, emotional, and physical abuses are considered standard in many relationships and family systems. Parents lash out at children. Teachers think it reasonable in the name of discipline to verbally abuse, attack, and put down the children they are supposedly teaching. A child who kills is no longer an uncommon phenomenon. The media regularly portray little violences as acceptable. Family members at each other's throats, attacks, sarcasm, and put-downs are presented as witty, normal human interaction. Ever wonder why the divorce rate is so high? Healthy relationships are seldom represented or modeled anywhere in our world or media.
Where have I been all my life? I never thought about how realities from previous generations of the media impact us. It never occurred to me that the world could be any different. I thought that's just the way it was. I never conceived that my hostility supports and contributes to the dynamic violence in the world.
Look around. You're not alone, Richard. These little violences rarely strike the sensibilities of anyone who's been trained to think of these forms of insult to human integrity as funny and even acceptable. From within the monumental violence of the way our world works, little violences are seen as meaningless. I believe they are the tributaries that join to produce the destructive river of violence so prevalent in our world culture. In my experience, the reason for the monumental violence in our culture is that many experience continuous violence from conception, violence in thought, word, action, and attitude. These are learned responses. Its harmful nature in the family has, to a great degree, been ignored, though it is the beginning point of all conflict, divorce, murder, and war. Children and adults are so confused as to what is reasonable, they often do not know when they're abusing others, being abused, or even abusing themselves. The end of this insanity on our planet begins when each of us acquires and uses the tools to heal the violence we do to ourselves and others. Peace is not an objective, it is a pathway to sanity and healing.
Fear and violence have been with us for all of history, Michael. I want to live in peace as much as the next guy, but do you honestly think you can eliminate our world's insanities with these tools? Why, that sounds like an impossible dream.
Do you believe fear is a natural thing for us as human beings?
All right.
I think we bought into a lie. I believe it is time for us to confront the lie and face ourselves. It's time to heal the structures that support mental, emotional, spiritual, verbal, and physical abuse. Hostility and violence in every form, within families, communities, and nations, must come to an end if we humans are to survive, let alone live in peace. Taking responsibility and refusing the hostility fix each time the mind automatically offers it is one of the keys to healing and aliveness. A shocking belief held by many people is that peace is not possible, nor is it desirable, and that violence is not only natural but necessary. It is a mind unwilling to be responsible and deal with its hurts so it can heal that promotes such an insane and barbaric dogma. That peace is not possible is a rationalization for violence used by those who cannot or will not control their own thoughts, words, and actions. Even a child can see through the insanities promoted as necessary. Let's have the courage to recover our lives and do the unthinkable. Let's question everything. Richard and I decided to stretch our legs by taking a walk to the lake. A brisk walk up the hill left us both puffing but refreshed by the clean Ozark air. When we returned from our walk, the focus of our discussion turned to resonance in the mind. I explained that the law of resonance is the law that governs all energy fields and is the law of energy exchange.
Now, what's resonance?
Well, imagine I hold up a middle C tuning fork and bring a second vibrating middle C tuning fork near it. What will happen?
The first fork will vibrate. I remember that experiment from physics class in high school.
What if I introduce a vibrating fork tuned to the F frequency?
Nothing happens. The two forks are tuned to two different frequencies. Therefore, they will not resonate with one another. The fork tuned to F will register nothing.
So if there's no resonance, there's no exchange of energy. Only when two fields are in tune or in harmony with each other is there exchange of energy between them. When they enter each other's sphere, the stronger field transfers some of its energy to the weaker field, which is strengthened. This is the same law that governs the function of the mind.
What do you mean, governs the mind?
Well, let's demonstrate. Don't think about the color of your car. What are you thinking about, Richard?
My blue car, resonance, I suppose.
Couldn't be anything else.
I could have decided to think about something else if I wanted to, though.
Yes, but not without first deciding not to think about your car, which is thinking about your car. With my words, I set up an energy field. Imagine your mind is like a filing cabinet, and you have a file on cars. My words resonated that file in your mind in the same way that the tuning forks resonated and interchanged energy or information. Your mind was stimulated into thought, quote-unquote thought, about your car. This action is not thinking at all, but simple resonance. It is the law that governs every process in the mind. Words are a frequency put out by the human voice. Our words resonate all information of similar frequencies in the mind that hears them. I call this the file folder effect. Let me lay out that idea. All information that relates to any particular topic is stored in a file, so to speak, with all like information. When you fire one set of brain cells in a file, the firing brain cells set up an energy field that tends to cause all other brain cells in that same file to fire. In my workshops, I demonstrate the file folder effect by asking the audience to answer a question and shout out their answers loudly enough to be heard. I then ask, what's the Lone Ranger's horse's name? Throughout the audience, I usually hear Silver, which is the horse's name, Tonto, and Trigger.
I can see the audience responding that way, Michael. But I don't understand what that has to do with resonance.
Well, when I ask the horse's name, each mind's file on old westerns resonates as a result of the vibration set up by my voice. Every mind delivers its internal reality, which is dependent not on my words, but on what my words resonate in each person in the audience. The same words are heard by every person, but the reality triggered is totally dependent on the content of each mind, on what is stored in brain cells, and which answer is closest to the surface in the resonated file. The reality perceived always comes from the content of the listening mind, just like the meanings we give to life. The law of resonance says that some of the energy of my voice transfers to the listener's brain cells containing realities about Silver. When the brain cells receive this energy, they fire and set up an internal vibration in that file. Every other brain cell in that file is then energized and tends to fire, hence Tonto and Trigger become possible answers, an expression of the file folder effect. If in our file on old westerns, Tonto or Trigger is closer to the surface than Silver, then that's our answer, even though it's not directly related to the question. Some actually call this automatic response mechanism thinking. I suspect we would be amazed if we knew how many people's entire lives were governed by this process, governed and limited by the body's mind, a mind that has, in the ancient teachings, been called the mind of Adam. So the file folder effect is not thinking. It is only information firing in brain cells. It is information cycling in the body's mind in response to input, either words, images, symbols, impulses, or sensations. Richard seemed intrigued with this concept and leaned toward me as he spoke.
Do you mean that anything that triggers the brain cells can be a catalyst to this file folder effect?
Yes, and if we're run by that effect, we're run by the past. Recall that removing realities from a mind is called forgiveness and is the key to taking charge of your life. Developing the skill of managing the output of the mind makes one the operator of his or her own mind. Richard, have you ever done anything you regret?
Unfortunately, more often than I care to admit.
Why did you do that?
well, fear, I guess. I didn't know any better, or maybe anger. A number of reasons, I suppose.
The only reason we ever do anything is because we have a reality in our minds that guides us to do that particular form of behavior. A young boy with limited realities in his mind, for example, might smash a valued antique. Is the child destructive? No. He simply does not have the realities in his mind to guide him in what we consider to be the proper handling of something fragile.
You mean if he were told repeatedly, as a result of not knowing how to handle something, that he was bad and destructive, well, those words might build up a reality in his mind. My God, that reality might actually drive him for his whole life.
If the child did not have access to the tool of forgiveness and undo that reality, chances are he would be destructive for his whole life, buying into the belief that he was born bad. Of course, there's no such thing as a bad child, but many bad children are the product of parents in a culture who don't know any better nor understand their role in structuring the realities in a child's mind. The world would change overnight if the media comprehended and took responsibility for the realities they pump into children and the goals they present to innocent minds.
This explains a lot of the violence and crime in our world. There is a saying that goes something like, it takes a community to raise a child. It sounds to me like every interaction with the whole community has an influence in building each child's reality. This is an awesome responsibility.
Yeah, it sure is. The power an individual or the media have in the way they present or model behavior can make the difference between shifting an internal reality from fantasy, a non-behavior-driving reality, to one that gets acted out, a behavior-driving reality. I believe that media, news, and public personalities have a tremendous influence and a great deal of responsibility for what is happening, especially for the realities our young people are accepting and acting out.
I used to think that parents who guarded carefully what their children did and with whom their children had contact were overprotective. Perhaps they understood the potential contribution the community makes in building their child's reality structure. This explains a lot about why children who have had no contact with a healthy community, be it in school or in a neighborhood, get into trouble. I'm going to do something about delivering what I've learned here today to children, to schools, to parents and teachers. Why, Michael, this is wonderful.
Well, we'll be delighted to support your effort in any way we can, Richard. Many people who study this work become teachers of it. We invite anyone who feels it is their purpose to teach these tools to do so and to assist us in fulfilling our family's commitment of making these tools available to every mind on the planet. Now, let's take a look at the next phase in understanding the file folder effect. Words can be used to trigger files and realities and kind of hook them together, so to speak. How long does it take to key realities together so they fire in concert with each other? Well, Richard, don't think about a purple alligator. Silly example, but if I see you in a week, a month, or a year and say, don't think about a purple, with what will your mind fill in the blank?
Why, alligator, of course, but I probably won't even remember that a year from now.
That may be true, but it illustrates the point. One of the things that puts an event into long-term memory is emotion. Repetition will drive the energy even deeper into the mind. Let's look at an all-too-typical example. Imagine, over the first decade or two of life, a young boy is taught, through being yelled at and punished, the conflicting thoughts that sex is dirty and he should save it for the one he loves. Considering the file folder effect, what results would you expect to see from those links in a mind? How do you suppose his relationships will go when he reaches adulthood?
And that sounds like fertile ground for insanity.
You got it. Until he can forgive the conflicting realities in his mind, anything that resonates sexuality will trigger, sex is dirty, save it for the one you love. Mm. The resultant flow of realities will probably leave him in conflict because hooked into those files whenever they're resonated are desire, guilt, conflict, and punishment. Do you see why negativity and punishment come into a marriage and violence results? Many people try to stay in control so they can live happily ever after, which is another thought key to relationship. All this adds up to more and more confusion. Each of the main realities in these files is highly emotionally charged, and key thing is, and linked together. What chance do you suppose that person has of having a good marriage? What do you suppose the resulting reality flow will be in the spouse's mind, considering the file folder effect?
I suspect it will be fairly crazy. Like I've been in my marriages.
Precisely. Confusion will be the result. Suppose we get two people in a marriage, each with similar realities, and they continuously resonate these kinds of brain cells in each other.
You mean like my marriages? Bedlam. Why, it's insane. Divorce, pain, hatred, revenge. It's like being at war.
Richard wept in grief and rage. I sat quietly and held the space of love as he processed through profound emotion. I admired his courage in facing these buried issues. I thought about how so many of us have to be up against the wall before we're willing to confront ourselves. I suspect that this is because we've been trained to numb our pain to the point where it takes a major crisis to break through our drug state and get our attention. I reassured him it was safe to feel what was coming up, and that facing these issues was how healing would happen. Richard expressed his relief and confided that he had not felt emotion so deeply since he was a child. His face took on a radiance as some of the sorrow it had reflected earlier ebbed away. We extended our example as we wondered what a couple living in the woods would go through in adjusting to each other. Richard shared,
"From my experience with intimate relationships, difficult."
I suggested that we look at the same couple in the middle of New York City, dealing with each other and the complexities of their interactions. Now compound all of that by adding the file folder effect, which is exaggerated by the stimulation of a metropolis. In the city, their senses are bombarded by movies, television, masses of people, magazines, newspapers, billboards, advertising in stores, taxicabs, buses. These media continuously impale each spouse's mind with both subliminal and overt messages of fear, guilt, sex, violence, hatred, drug and alcohol abuse. If their minds contain highly charged emotional realities connected to any of these issues, and they're continuously being resonated into activity, how sane can they be? Is it any wonder people turn to drugs and alcohol to cope?
This is overwhelming, Michael. You're describing my life and the life of almost everyone I know. I'm feeling like this is so big we could never change it.
That sounds like the world's brainwashing that says you're powerless over what's happening. You're only one person. Why don't you just give up and go along with the program? Richard, I invite you to consider that you need only do your own work, and you have as much power as any human being who has ever lived. You are capable of breaking through and making changes both within and without. The first step in convincing people change is impossible is to persuade them that pain is normal, and it's not. Due to the file folder effect, once pain is accepted in a mind, it can be hooked up to any reality in that mind through the use of words and images. And any image that pain hooks into, it distorts. The more powerful the medium delivering the message, the greater is its potential for distorting the mind's output. Richard, just as you must look inside yourself if you want to heal, I'm suggesting we must each look at how we, as human beings, have created the insanities in our world. I know it starts to look overwhelming as we dig into these issues, but overwhelm is just one stage in the healing process. These issues we've been speaking of are at the root of the abuse we do and the abuse we experience in our relationships, in our families, our communities, and in our whole world. They are the source of the confusion that leads people to acts of violence, divorce, hatred, vengeance, crime, and war. We must change these dynamics in ourselves if we're to thrive, which is what we're designed to do.
No, you've lost me. I don't even know what you're talking about. How can you change the dynamics, these dynamics that are so deeply ingrained?
Forgiveness. This tool of healing allows us to remove distorted realities from our minds. I'm talking about dealing with all the realities we've accepted that lead to confusion. So many people have bought into the sex is dirty, save it for the one you love, and other insane lines of thinking that relationship and family seem doomed in our culture. True forgiveness of all painful realities is where our healing lies. If we refuse to do our healing work, we can easily be manipulated and controlled by anyone who knows how to push our buttons and resonate unconsciousness. I'm referring, Richard, to having the basic skill of removing realities that do not serve us, and at the risk of sounding patronizing, the overwhelming feeling you have is exactly my point. We've resonated all the realities inside of you during our conversation today. Notice, it is a beautiful autumn day, and we're safe and secure on our deck in the Ozarks. We even have clean air to breathe. The only difference between the beginning of our conversation and now is the realities that have been resonated in your mind. Notice that nothing has changed in the world. The only thing different is what has been stirred up in your mind. You're in overwhelm only because of that. It's an inside job. This is the beginning of some deep process which will probably continue for months to come. A little overwhelm can be expected.
Okay, I accept that. But I don't understand why it's happening. Why all this confusion?
Richard, the nature of thoughts is energy, and they follow the laws of energy. I suspect they have both wave and particle properties, much like light. If I shine a red, a blue, and a green light on a plain white surface, what will you see?
I'll see a red, green, and blue light reflecting off the surface if you shine them one at a time. But if you shine them all at one spot, they'll be mixing the colors.
Okay. Now, bear with me. There's a point to this. When the realities are resonated in a mind, their properties are much like the light. If they surface one at a time, like the single light shining on a spot, there will be clarity in the thoughts behind that reality, and confusion will be impossible. However, if several conflicting realities try to surface simultaneously, like the three lights shining on the one spot, there will be a mix, a confusion in the thoughts that generate the conflicting realities. Richard, I've become aware of a few issues for myself to work out and heal from today's conversation. I'm sure we fired some realities for you to deal with in our interaction. Until you remove the conflicts and clarify your reality structure for yourself, confusion will tend to be the result of such a process. And of course, I have to do the same for me.
Well, the file folder effect is taking its toll on me at this moment. If a conversation such as this one we are having stirs up this much feeling, what chance does the average person have in life?
Well, most people don't allow the space in their lives to look this deeply into themselves. They keep themselves drugged and on the run with no time to feel their feelings. If hidden feelings surface during dinner, hey, another scotch or a serving of a sugar-laden dessert will take care of keeping those feelings suppressed. If the drugs from the night before slow their waking process in the morning, just jumpstart yourself with caffeine, nicotine, or sugar. This behavior is so prevalent and is not recognized for what it is. It's addiction and suppression. Busyness is another drug that is used in our culture to avoid looking at our issues. Let go of these drugs, and layers of confusion will surface as you do your work, and that is desirable. As conflicting realities surface and you forgive them, new levels of clarity and empowerment will come. Healing occurs if you deal with and release painful realities and let go of the burdens you suppress and keep hidden. Let go of the inclination to use your energy or drugs to avoid, numb out, and stuff what you don't want to see. You've got to release it.
You resonate hope in me, Michael. It looks like a giant task, but the other way of living sure hasn't worked. Why not do it differently? Well, even though I've dug myself into a pit, I'm starting to see a way out. I'm grasping that the cause and the solution to the insanity that I've experienced is of my own making. I see a light at the end of the tunnel, and this time it's not an oncoming train. I think I can actually get a handle on this and what's happened. I might even be able to create a decent, loving relationship with this understanding and with these tools.
The goal of this work is to empower people to become conscious of everything in their lives. People who are not conscious operators of their own minds can be programmed by others to react with any reality in response to any situation. When it comes to deciding whether or not to do your work, Richard, what else is there to do? Once you see that your whole life flows from your inner dynamics, how else can you proceed but to commit yourself and move forward?
Well, I could see myself sinking into oblivion, becoming a hermit in Wyoming. I could just quit.
True, but that would say to me that you didn't really hear or develop enough brain cells to see that there is something you can do about your life and about the world. It's not unusual for me to hear from people who attended one of my workshops 10 or 15 years ago. They often tell me they thought I was nuts back then, but a phrase or an idea stuck with them. Then they saw examples of that idea often enough, and things finally clicked. they decided that they had to know more about the principles of this work. It's kind of like the parable of the sowing of the seeds. Even if one does not do his or her mind gardening, sooner or later these ideas take hold sufficiently to form sensible realities in a mind. This work is innate knowledge for people. I'm not teaching them anything they don't already know. It's just a matter of the inner truth breaking through the layers of insane realities that have been accepted in the mind. Once you clear up the twisted ideas and clean out the corrupted files, this work becomes natural. This information should be kindergarten stuff, conversations children have on the playground, yet it's all but missing from our culture. The absence of an understanding and experience of love is the reason it is so rare, I suspect. Richard and I went back to our discussion of love. I put forward the thought that one of the keys to the healing process is clarifying the idea of love, which has been ill-defined, misused, and distorted. Cleaning up its definition in our minds is an important piece of foundational work. 2,000 years ago, we were taught love was the most important law to human existence. It must come first if intelligence is to be maintained. Teaching love is not religious. It's the most practical thing in the world. One of the major pitfalls we humans have fallen into is that of making any teaching based on love sound like religion. Many people throw out teachings based on love or only give them lip service because they think those teachings are religion, which they've been subtly taught to reject. Richard thought the ideas on love sounded good, but wanted to know how to love someone who'd just been abusive to him. He said in an exasperated tone,
"Who could feel anything but anger and hate in that kind of situation?"
Well, to love, you must first straighten out your definition of the word. This may sound trite, Richard, but the people who can feel love when attacked know what love is and do not have realities called anger or hate in them.
But
stay with me for just a minute. Remember, our goal is to let go of the old beliefs and manipulative teachings long enough to build some new brain cells. If when I'm finished, what I've said doesn't make sense, throw it out and go back to the old way. Love in Aramaic does not mean cooperate with and help the person who's beating up on you. It does not mean accept every atrocity with a smile and pretend all is well when it is not. Love does not mean that you don't hold people accountable for their behavior. Love is not the passive state of suppressing your anger so you look like a saint.
So it's okay to be angry with somebody that abuses you? I thought so.
The reality in your head is giving you information not delivered by my words, Richard. It's okay to get angry with someone if you want your mind to be stupid while you interact with them.
Well, what is that supposed to mean? It sounds like you're playing games with me, and I don't like it.
Well, there's an old saying that the truth will set you free, but first it's going to bring up all your anger and rage, I said, and kind of trying to lighten the energy a little. Richard, the word love in this culture is so distorted, its true meaning is almost lost. Most of the entertainment industry would have us believe love is sexual athletics and satiation. Others would have us believe it is self-denial and sacrifice. Still others would have us think we show love by receiving their abuses graciously. Think about it. Who has something to gain by our believing in these bizarre definitions of love?
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, if I believe love is sexual athletics as portrayed on the screen, might I pay for more sick movies and demand more intense and bizarre sexuality in order to be satiated? Might I think what is played out in movies is normal and try to live up to the reality I've come to believe is true? Might I find myself wanting to participate in the outrageous habits for which much of the entertainment industry is famous? We need to recognize, Richard, that fulfilling outrageous fantasies will never satisfy us. It will only lead to even more bizarre behaviors. Until we do, we will continue to repeat those behaviors, wondering, is that all there is? And what's wrong with me? If we hold painful realities in our mind, it does not matter how many of the quote-unquote rewards based on an incorrect understanding of life we receive, happiness will still elude us. No matter how many possessions, how much money, sex, power, or fame we achieve, these things can never satisfy us because they're empty and false. Satiation masquerades as satisfaction, but when it's experienced, it can't deliver its tempting guarantee. I told Richard the story of the old man in his deathbed who was asked for the secret to happiness. The old man is said to have replied, "For years and years I searched for what people told me would make me happy, and then I just decided to serve life and be happy without it. Happiness is a state of mind, a choice we make, not a result of possessing things or being in control of people or circumstances. People often use the sensation that comes from possessing things as a substitute for happiness, for relationship, and as a way of not dealing with their internalized pain. Real relationship is dead in the glamour industry's definition of love. Have you ever felt used as a sexual object and then thrown away? Anyone who buys into the common media definition of love becomes a sexual object in their own minds and in the minds of others, and of course, like other objects, they're thrown away after use.
I've been on both sides of that scenario. I don't understand why it has to be that way. I would love to be in a true, honest, and real relationship. Perhaps that is impossible until I straighten out some of my conflicting realities.
I think you're right. We tend to live exactly what we've learned. And if we've been used and abused, it takes work to live differently. Relationships are a wondrous place for nurturing, support, and healing if we can remove the confusing and conflicting realities we've hooked into them. My experience of people who reject or cannot form long-term relationships is they have so much pain in their relationship file, they have to keep on the move or they're going to have to face what's hidden inside of them.
I've been on the run too long. Who promotes this insanity? Why is there so much of this confusion in the world?
To answer that, notice who receives the benefits of the twisted understanding of love. Anyone who distorts truth to gain something for themselves is in so much pain and lives in such inward poverty that they cannot live honestly. They think they must manipulate to have anything for themselves, and even to survive. Have you ever noticed that the promoter of the idea that love is self-sacrifice always has their hand out, and those who feed on abusing others push the idea that love is the gracious acceptance of their abuse? Those who promote love as sex have a lot more sex objects of whom to take advantage, and those with the victim mentality get the benefit of playing out the role to which they're dedicated and addicted.
I'm not quite keeping up with everything you're saying, but I get its importance. I suppose I have to clean up some of the clouds that I've allowed in my mind to accept and build more brain cells about what love really is before I will fully grasp it. However, you've gotten my attention again. I have a question that's been bothering me all my life, Michael. What is love?
I don't know what it is.
What? We're having this discussion about love and you can't even tell me what it is?
I didn't say I don't have any ideas, Richard. I just hesitate to reduce such an important matter to words. Words are too small for such a topic. In Aramaic, it appears that love is what we are. It is the stuff of human existence. Without it, we are not human, but reduced to less than animal status. In the Aramaic scriptures, we're told that we are made in the image and likeness of the Creator, and that the Creator is love. Do you remember when you were a child looking around at the way the world worked, knowing in your heart it was supposed to be about something other than what you were seeing, something other than the almost universal strife?
Mm-hmm.
Look into the eyes of a child. How many times on an energy level must that child be violated to cause him to hate? How much propaganda does it take to grow a child into a person who can kill, into a person who believes that the world is a fearsome place, that life is poverty, relationships hell, and sex dirty? What does it take for people to believe they're sinners, condemned by a creator called love, in whose image and likeness they're made? Why is it that there's such confusion in the world? For the answer, check out who benefits from programmed unconsciousness.
I'm not sure this is what you mean, but I can think back to being a kid, watching the hypocrites fight and belittle each other, and I knew that this was not how we were supposed to behave. I kept coming back to my abusers with trust and total love and kept getting wiped out.
Tears rolled down his face as the words escaped his lips. So you took on their behavior, Richard?
What? No, I wouldn't do that.
Are you sure?
Well, I've never been abusive. I've never hit anybody. Not in my entire life.
Have you ever withdrawn love, put down, or tried to control others for your own benefit? Have you used anger, money, or things to manipulate others into behaving the way you want it? Have you ever withheld love from yourself?
Well, yes, but that's not abuse.
Think back to being a kid that kept loving those that abused him. He only wanted one thing, to be loved. How did he feel when love was withheld and he was manipulated with money, threats, and put-downs?
I asked that question quietly, aware that some very tender feelings were surfacing for Richard.
I think abused and alone.
I sensed tears just under the surface, tears that had been held inside for a long time. It feels to me like there might be a lot of sadness, grief, and uncried tears wanting to let loose, Richard.
I was taught it was wrong to cry.
That is another reality with which we've been brainwashed. Macho doesn't work. If we cannot accurately feel our feelings, we're out of touch with an important guidance system. Recall, Richard, the operative principle here is if I'm in pain, I'm in error. The pain is an attempt on the part of the body to warn you of error and be of help. Notice you felt abused when all the things you normally do to people, yourself included, were done to you as a child.
You mean I'm an abuser? I've never thought of myself that way. I always considered myself a nice guy. I thought what I was doing was normal.
Well, these are behaviors that few have escaped. It is an almost universal phenomenon, an opportunity for healing that virtually every one of us gets. Unfortunately, abuse and exploitation have become normal for many people, but that does not make it natural. Remember when, as a child, you knew life was about love and abuse was a foreign concept? I believe that abuse can be inherited, but usually it must be learned. A person stuck in the mindset of the world, whether teacher, parent, politician, or minister, through the denial of loving feelings and the use of abuse, helps to build many distorted realities into people's minds. The distorted realities are then used to control and exploit. This is done with our cooperation, and the realities we choose to identify with direct us to live in a way other than our natural inclination, which is to love.
I can kind of remember when I knew I shouldn't treat people the way I do.
Richard almost sounded like a child as he spoke.
I always wanted to be loving to people, but I was hurt so often. I guess I hardened myself to the effects of my abrasive behaviors and my tendency to bully people.
We explored the idea of abuse and came to the conclusion that abuse and withholding love are learned responses. It became apparent from our discussion that the reality structure in most people's minds, which is formed as a result of their distorted learning experiences, determines their behavior. Each distorted experience is a result of the combination of internal realities interacting with environmental influences. Behavior-driving realities are those which have been observed to reduce conscious and unconscious stress in ourselves or in those we look up to, those who fit our mind's definition of success. Which realities become behavior-driving often result from unconscious energy dynamics in which choice is not a part of the process. In Aramaic, blocking awareness of abusive behaviors, of love, and or of feelings was called hardening the heart. Each hardened heart is convinced that to act in accord with its distorted reality structure is normal. When we can't feel, we can be convinced to do all sorts of insane things to ourselves and to others and think it's normal. We observed from our own experience that a person with a hardened heart remains convinced his actions are right when he does them, even though he says others are insane when they do exactly the same things. Richard reiterated his understanding of what he called that intriguing attribute of the mind, blockage of truth.
A mind in denial literally hides information from itself. It does not see that information contrary to what it believes.
That seems to be how it works. If we hold an emotionally charged goal of being right, the mind hides all evidence that enables us to see the truth. The only thing available is error. Think about people who abuse but deny it. They reinterpret their behavior to justify it or blot the truth out of awareness so they can continue to think of themselves as right. The truth of the abuse they do is invisible to them. This is a condition that can be corrected only by love of truth. Have you ever, for no apparent reason, been abruptly thrown out of someone's life or perhaps thrown another out and wondered why?
As a matter of fact, I was just thinking about a time when a seemingly close friendship ended over an inconsequential argument. She blamed me for something I knew nothing about, and there was no way to persuade her to think about it differently. I've often wondered why that happened, but I think you just explained it. I'm understanding it for the very first time. Her mind could only give her the evidence she needed to make me wrong rather than to accept responsibility. Blocking my input was her way to protect herself. Her heart was hardened against the truth.
If you want to do an interesting experiment, show someone evidence of a truth they do not want to see. Unless they love truth deeply, they will, first of all, tell you that you're crazy or imagining things, or they forget the event ever happened. Second, they'll leave, often physically, by making an excuse, or mentally leaving by wandering off to other topics and not acknowledging the conversation you're attempting to have with them. Third response is they'll turn on you in some form of manipulation, usually anger, to stop you from presenting your information or accuse you of a similar defect, telling you about the time when you did the same thing as though that justifies their behavior and makes them right. The fourth, and it's pretty heavy duty, is they'll attack you fiercely in a manner that's all out of proportion to the issue involved. You will wonder what hit you. Chances are you'll end up unwelcome in that person's life. If you continue to present the evidence they are in denial about, be prepared to duck so you keep your head. There's so much insanity in our culture.
I recognize that experiment and have been attacked for doing exactly what you describe. But do you really believe that many people are crazy?
I'm talking about insanity, not craziness, Richard. In this work, an insane mind is defined as one that lacks the condition of love. A mind without love is a mind without real choices, therefore insane. In Aramaic thought, it was known that without love, humans were easy to take advantage of, weak and vulnerable. Love is a major key because it inoculates the mind against insane behavior. That is why it is called the first law. A lack of awareness of this law is the recipe for insanity.
I'm lost again. This is starting to make sense, and then the sensible part seems to evade me.
Well, Richard, that's kind of what happens when you're building brain cells. The realities that show up in your mind from newly developed brain cells are kind of fragile and easily distorted by conflicting realities from the past. That is why I ask people to investigate, think on these ideas for themselves, and not believe a word I'm saying.
Oh, come on, Michael. Obviously, you're saying all of what you do so people believe it.
Well, actually, Richard, no. I teach to build a new framework and tools with which to experience life differently. A thought system built on someone else's experience is just a belief system. It will tend to crumble and take senseless turns under pressure. For instance, you asked earlier about the definition for love. I don't have one. But I do know a way to experience it and what signals will tell you when love is present.
What are the signals that tell you when love is present?
Well, first, the mind that holds the condition of love, in the ancient Aramaic, perfect love, is peaceful and patient in all circumstances. This mind takes responsibility for any disturbance it has, and therefore heals itself quickly and creates a space of healing for others. Additional fruit of the mind of love includes tenderness, compassion, and gentleness. A mind that proclaims it punishes and brandishes fear in the name of love is either deceiving or it is a deceived mind. No such fruit is possible from love.
That makes sense out of a lot of the senselessness I've seen. What did you mean when you said you had a way to experience love?
Well, we could call this an experiential definition. Love is what you experience just after you use the process of true forgiveness. It is what is left when the mind's realities get out of the way. Now, if I tell you that and you believe it, we'll have another belief system in the world and another belief system to fight over and defend. When you have a personally experienced, is there anything to fight over? No. Only the insecure who don't know what love is have to force and fight over their BS, their own belief systems. Only the insecure need to have everyone believe the way they do so that their beliefs will not be challenged. Richard, each of us was created in a state of love, and we deserve to experience that state 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If we're not experiencing it, something is out of place. When we withhold love from another, it is we who suffer from that withdrawal of love. It is we who experience the lack of love. Remember when you knew as a child about the way the world was supposed to operate? My function in the world is to deliver tools to people and point them toward the results possible with the use of the tools. My goal is to inspire you and others to use the tools and then arrive at your own conclusions about life. Of course, I think when the evidence is in, this work will prove itself correct, but the world does not need another belief system. It needs the experience of love. Love in Aramaic is a condition in the mind that each individual is responsible for maintaining. It is the fuel that empowers the human mind to function correctly. Without love, the mind is dysfunctional and we do insane things. Tell me, Richard, when are you most intelligent? When do you have the most flexibility, the widest range of choices, and the highest levels of creativity? Is it when you're angry, afraid, or hostile?
Obviously, most everything that I've ever done and regretted was done when I was in one of those states. Let me be clear on this. Are you saying that love is the key to intelligence?
If intelligence means the ability to choose, absolutely. Notice when a choice is made in anger or upset, a lack of love, it is no choice at all. We are simply driven by resonance, by emotional realities from our past, driven to do things often against our own will and choice. This only happens in a mind that lacks love. This lack of love, which compromises intelligence, has led most of humanity to be shackled to religious and political systems that are based on fear. We need to understand how to forgive our fears, or, as said in the Aramaic scriptures, cast out the demon fear. If we do not, we will find ourselves unwittingly acting in support of that demon. A mind without the condition of love promotes and reinforces fear at every turn. No true spiritual teacher who understands how life and the mind operates uses fear to motivate.
Now, I've seen fear motivate people to do the right things.
In the short term, I agree. You can get people to do things out of fear. Have you noticed the long-term result is always a disaster, however? For instance, a parent forces a child with threats and abuse. The child obeys the parent out of fear, but in the end hates them and passes the force and abuse on to others. The reason is the tools used to produce a result will always produce a result like the tools. Children are learning sponges. They're believing creatures. What they live with, they learn, and then they live whatever it is they have learned.
Why, this makes too much sense.
Yes, and there is a peace when one achieves a practical understanding of tools that work and has the intellectual basis to reinforce that understanding. This work draws on all disciplines in order to build a solid foundation for the undoing of unconsciousness and for a life that is harmonious and peaceful. With its synthesis of different disciplines, it's a big chunk to bite off and chew. It takes patience and time to build the brain cells and integrate each of the disciplines upon which this work is built. That foundation is what makes these tools fully available. Some unconsciousness as you undo the patterns of the past and move into understanding and knowledge is to be expected. Allowing deeper issues to surface in the presence of love, it burns them off, so to speak. If you are willing to look into yourself, your family interactions, the dynamics of your culture, healing accelerates. An unwillingness to look deeper means that old patterns will tend to be passed on and played out by the next generation. Conscious, active, present love is the key to healing whatever needs to be healed.
What is the best tool for really, truly getting a space of love within relationships with children, spouses, or myself, and healing those generational patterns?
When someone triggers a healing opportunity, the first thing to do is to be responsible for your mind's output. Breathe and forgive. Learn to hold the condition of love in your mind in all circumstances, regardless of what your mind prompts you to do. We call that love, all-encompassing love. The tool, My Commitment, from our Healing Through Relationships workshop, was developed to assist in creating that space of love. It's a powerful key to staying on track and keeping love in your mind when you feel turmoil. It's the best reminder I've found to get me back to a loving space when upset surfaces. Speak it at least daily in your closest relationships and say it out loud to yourself while you're looking in the mirror.
Well, how does it go?
I promise to trust you enough to tell you the truth and treat you lovingly, gently, and with respect. I will do this in my thoughts, words, and actions, whether in your presence or not. In every interaction, I will look for and acknowledge the highest and best in you as I surrender to love, our true nature. My connection to my source and nurturing my relationship with you are always more important than any issue. If anything unlike love comes up, I will hold this in my heart and listen as I learn to speak, experience, and be responsible for my own realities and feelings. I am here for and with you. I will keep communication open and keep love conscious, active, and present as we celebrate life.
Oh, that's beautiful.
As Richard and I reviewed some of his family dynamics, we processed several issues he had with his mother. I suggested that it might be valuable to consider that his mother probably came by her behavior, her off-the-mark patterns, the same way he did. He acknowledged that she very likely never saw what she did as abuse, but rather as a way to protect herself just as he had. Abuse is one behavior that tends to be transmitted from generation to generation. Facing and processing through the abusive patterns is the best way I know to stop the behavior from being passed on to our children. This work is about taking on the generations for the generations. What you don't deal with will be passed on. What you are willing to face, sort out, and heal will no longer infect family dynamics. The pattern then stops with you.
Does that mean my daughter has the same issues I do? You mean if I heal, she won't have to go and deal with them?
It is very probable that she grew up reacting in some way to the same issues as you do. I'd be willing to bet that you have unintentionally treated her in a similar fashion to the way your mother treated you.
Hmm.
As you heal the issues with your mother, not only will your relationship with her improve, most likely your relationship with your daughter will shift as well.
Sometimes my daughter avoids me like the plague, and I've always wondered why. Now I think I know. She used to tell me I treated her poorly, but I never listened. I didn't see it that way. I guess my mom didn't either. Come to think of it, my mom used to brush me off the same way my daughter says that I do to her. It feels like a relief to know that I can do things differently and develop a more loving relationship with her. You know, I'm feeling pretty good. I think I might be feeling that empowerment feeling you were talking about earlier. For the first time in a long time, I'm feeling like I can do something about my life.
Richard, my mind keeps going back to a thought I had when we were talking about the issues around your mother. Would you be willing to take a look at that?
What the heck? I feel pretty good, considering what I've been through today. If someone told me I could uncover and deal with events and issues of such proportions as I've come to today and get to the other side with a smile on my face, I'd have said that we're out of their minds.
Well, recall that the key to process and healing is holding that space of love. Bringing these issues to the surface in another setting could lead to craziness.
Is this the kind of thing that people do at your intensive workshops?
That's the focus. In an intensive, we work to give the best tools and understanding possible. The rest is process, and it's like watching miracles happen when a number of people get together and do healing work. I know, Richard, that you wouldn't engage me in this conversation to avoid looking at the issue I asked about. Are you willing to look at that one?
I'm willing.
A trace of fear flashed across his face. Have you ever thought that living with you, Richard, might be like walking through a minefield?
No, of course not.
Are you feeling defensive right now, Richard?
Well, perhaps a little. Wouldn't you be?
Well, probably, yeah. I want to be clear that the purpose of bringing things to the surface is to gently look, own them, and let go of what does not work. I'm on your team and want to support you in that process. Has anyone ever given you the feedback about that minefield before?
Mm-hmm.
Richard did admit that he'd been told more than once that living with him was like walking on eggshells. He again affirmed that he'd never thought of himself in that way. Seldom do we see ourselves as others see us. And most people never take the time to listen to what others are really saying. Truly taking the time to listen to others provides us with the opportunity to look differently at unconsciously driven behavior, as does being aware of our responses to what others say. I spoke about him making a practice of searching for his patterns of unconscious driven behavior. I reminded him of our opening conversation or our misconversation about responsibility. Recall, Richard, We each experienced the same actuality. We each heard identical words, but your listening spoke to you of fault and blame, while mine informed me of responsibility. Remember the upset that surfaced for you and how much hostility you expressed?
Well, actually, I didn't express nearly as much as I felt at the moment.
Well, that's good. When upset surfaces, in this work we call it an opportunity to forgive, an opportunity to learn to let go of the tendency to blame others for what they trigger in us. Most people tend to experience their mind's interpretation of an event in the world and think that that's what is actually happening. We tend to think ours is the only truth. Like ripples distort an image on the surface of a pond, there's always some distortion of the images output from the mind when we're in upset. The truth cannot be reflected accurately in a disturbed mind.
If I'm clear on the bottom line of this work, it is that at every moment we are experiencing our own reality, correct?
Yes.
You're saying that our realities are made up of internal information and not caused by outside events.
That's it.
What we've been trained to think of as the actual event in the world is really actually in our heads, and what happens in our heads is distorted by the upsets and grievances we hold.
The world repeatedly triggers the realities we hold on to, and then we wonder, why is this happening to me again? Recall now that projection and externalization result in blaming our inner happenings on others. When in blame, the tendency is to think that the outside event is causing your experience, and it's not. Projection doesn't work to alleviate pain because when you pretend the problem is outside, you leave the pain inside and cut yourself off from being able to resolve it. The reason running away does not work to put an end to your pain is that you take your painful realities with you wherever you go. Has moving ever done much to change the quality of your relationships?
No, I guess avoidance is not an answer.
We talked about the idea that anger does not work and is never justified. We also explored the stresses involved in holding anger in the body and the pain from the tensions of keeping falsehoods in place. We considered the possibility that as these patterns are passed on, they might contribute to what is now thought of as genetically inherited disease.
Is it possible that family disease patterns can be changed, Michael?
Absolutely. That is an issue we cover in the workshop Empowered to Heal. My experience is that holding the space of conscious, active, present love while unresolved issues surface can shift any energy pattern. Richard was reaching new levels of clarity and enthusiasm in his process. Anyone who's done this work knows that the event that follows a new level of empowerment is often a healing crisis. It is at this point in the process that many people become filled with self-doubt about their ability to truly heal their pain. For some, the process seems too hard, others too complicated, for some too simple, and still others, the pain seems too deep. He looked forlorn as old feelings of hopelessness surfaced for healing.
This sounds so hopeless. If all of my pain is inside of me, how can I ever hope to get away from it? Why are we not all taught as children that we create our own reality? How will I ever work this out in my own relationships? How can I ever...
Oh, hold on, Richard. Slow down. Remember, these feelings will pass. The surfacing of hopelessness is an opportunity to deal with that reality in your mind, an opportunity to learn forgiveness. You are at least learning these things now. Most people go through their entire lives without ever discovering what's going on, without ever having tools. Why we were not taught this as children? Oh, Benjamin Franklin made a statement that I think sums it up perfectly. You will observe with concern how long a useful truth may be known to exist before it is generally received and practiced upon. Richard, I've got some good news and some bad news. The reason for your distress is your new level of empowerment. Your pain signals the opportunity to be aware of patterns that do not work and heal them. That's the good news.
Shouldn't my new level of empowerment make me feel better, Michael?
Well, definitely. And notice you did feel better a little earlier, and now the next layer surfaces.
Huh.
The blocks that to that empowerment being actualized in your life must be surfaced and healed. Everything unlike your empowerment must be forgiven. This is only possible when you've reached a higher level of vitality than your norm.